Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. Social media pioneer Andy Carvin drew high praise from fellow journalists for his coverage of the revolutions in Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, and Syria. The NPR reporter and strategist tracked the Arab Spring events in real time from thousands of miles away in Washington. Carvin cultivated Twitter and social media sources into a new form of journalism. This time, civilians on the ground controlled the news. On today's program, we'll talk with Andy Carvin about his new book. It's a first-person account called Distant Witness: Social Media, the Arab Spring, and a Journalism Revolution. But first, World Watch. Tensions continue to rise on the Korean Peninsula. North Korea was hit with a new round of sanctions at the beginning of the week. The Hermit Kingdom then declared the armistice that ended its war with South Korea is invalid. South Korea says a unilateral move to end the peace agreement is not legally possible. Although the border remains quiet, North Korea cut off its telephone hotline with South Korea. And the latest salvo got personal, an insult against South Korea's first female president. North Korea said Wednesday that her, quote, venomous swish of skirt was to blame for rising tensions. Over in the Middle East, Sinai is in a state of emergency. A government official expressed fear that jihadists could soon attack police on the peninsula, which is located between Egypt and Israel and Saudi Arabia. Military units are set up on highways and checkpoints, and border security has been increased. Last August, Islamist gunmen killed 15 Egyptian policemen and seized two military vehicles on the Sinai. In Malaysia, the Royal Sulu Army has retreated into the jungles of Borneo as soldiers swept the rural villages that sheltered the Muslim rebels. Malaysian fighter jets bombed a seaside village before ground forces took control. At least 54 Sulu fighters and 8 local policemen have been killed. Hungary's parliament voted to change the constitution to get around policies previously rejected by the country's constitutional court. This is the fourth amendment of the constitution since Prime Minister Viktor Orban came to power 3 years ago. Hungarians protested outside parliament. They voiced concerns that the government may now have unchecked power over the judiciary, banking, and media. Finally, it looks like Saudi Arabia may be ending public beheadings. A committee made up of representatives from 3 ministries reported Islamic law now permits changing to a system of public executions by firing squad. Human rights advocates have criticized Saudi Arabia for being the only country in the world where a death sentence results in beheading in a public square. But the kingdom's ministers said there's a practical reason for the change, a lack of qualified swordsmen. Now, the biggest news of the day. After several days of voting, the Catholic Church announced yesterday the selection of a new pope. He's an Argentinian cardinal, Jorge Mario Bergoglio. He greeted the thousands gathered at St. Peter's Square as the church's newest spiritual leader. Pope Francis, as he will be known, is the first non-European pope in over 1,000 years, and he's the first from Latin America. To give us a sense of what the mood is like in Argentina, we're speaking to Carolina Escudero. She's a freelance journalist based in Argentina, and she runs the University of Missouri's Buenos Aires program. Carolina, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So what was the reaction in Argentina when the word began to spread about having a fellow Argentinian as a pope?
Well, it was, first of all, a big surprise because we were considering that the pope could be from Italy or Brazil, brother.
Yeah, he was a
Or Canada.
So right, he was a 25-1. The odds against him becoming pope were great. He was a 25-1 in the betting parlors.
So we didn't expect that. Absolutely not. And we think he didn't too. Today, her sister was talking on the news, and she was like, well, my brother left, and I said to him, see you soon, and he was like, yes, see you pretty soon. So we think that he didn't expect at all, too. So that was a big surprise, and we had many different reactions, you know, because some people from the, I will talk about Buenos Aires.
Right.
Some people were like surprised and happy because it's known, Bergoglio is known as someone very spiritual and related with the poor people.
Right. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about that. He's a Jesuit and he's known to for living in an apartment rather than the Archbishop's palace, and he passed on a chauffeured limousine, takes the bus and subway to work.
Yes, it's true. Many people could see him every day taking the subway, and he was like walking on the street. We drink mate here, you know, it's the original mate from original drink from Argentina, and he used to share this mate thing is like coffee for you. He used to go to the stadium to watch some football. It's a fan of the Argentinian football.
Uh-huh.
So he was always trying to be in touch with people, and he used to go to poor neighborhoods, neighborhoods that they can be dangerous in a certain way for Christians and in places that the church is not the most important thing. And he used to go there alone without any protection. And he used to talk and stay during the whole day with people there. And he was showing, he used to show like a lot of respect, like, okay, if you are not a Catholic and you're Protestant or Buddhist or the only thing I will ask you is to do your best. I am not here to convince you about becoming a Catholic. So this is a part of his work here. On the other hand, we have people that they are not that happy because they consider that during the 70s, the period of the coup d'etat,
right,
the dirty war here, he was involved with the militaries and he didn't play a human rights role here in Argentina,
so some people
are like not that happy about him.
So he didn't speak out against the atrocities against the people?
No. And he was, there are some pictures since yesterday I'm receiving but I received a lot of emails about we should remember what he was doing during the 70s, and you received pictures of Bergoglio, you know, with the militaries in the church talking together. And so you have the society is really divided, okay? So the people that they're really involved with the human rights and the memory, the work of the memory we have done about the 70s, they're unhappy about that because they consider that he is not representing the country and our issues. Other people consider, like, as a Jesuit and a spiritual leader, he had to forgive these people, and he was doing a great job during the 70s. And he's a good example of Argentina, too, about the memory and forgiveness. But we can see how divided is the society right now about that.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for providing this perspective of this big story.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. The Washington Post has called Andy Carvin, quote, a one-man Twitter news bureau. New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof describes Carvin as the maestro of the region's Twitter feed. And Jeff Jarvis refers to him as a prototype for a new kind of journalist. Carvin said he was just personally fascinated with Arab countries and was drawn into the conflict when the context he was following started tweeting about a fruit vendor in Tunisia who set himself on fire. He writes in his new book that no one could have anticipated that this online chatter would, quote, change the world, journalism, and my life forever.
Andy, thank you for joining the program.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This is a real eye-opening book for a traditional journalist like myself and many of our the other people who join our program. And as Jeff Jarvis pointed out in his foreword, The Distant Witness is a dramatic page-turner. How did...
I really appreciate that.
Yeah, sure. Let's start with Tunisia, where the book began. And you spent some time there, and you had some experience, and then all hell started to break loose, and you started to get some tweets.
in my prior job before coming to NPR, I spent some time in Tunisia working on internet policy projects. And while I was there, I had a chance to meet some of their local bloggers, as well as the blogging in exile community. These are people who had been forced out of the country because of their political views. And even though Tunisia and the Middle East in general didn't really relate to my work at NPR directly, I kept in touch with them through Twitter just because they were interesting people. And then one day in December 2010, I started seeing several of them tweeting about protests that were spreading around the country because a young man had set himself on fire to protest a government official confiscating his vegetable cart. And I didn't see many media sources talking about it yet. There were a handful of them, but not many. But because I knew a little bit about Tunisia, I thought I'd keep up on it and see what happened. And as the revolution grew and grew over the next few weeks, my pool of sources and my network grew with it. And so during the last couple of days of the revolution, I found myself online 17, 18 hours a day. I don't know exactly how long it was, but I was trying to stay awake as long as possible because so many things were happening so fast. And it was clear that it was reaching some type of climax. But what that climax would be, we weren't really sure yet. And so when the time finally came that their president fled the country, I saw a tweet from one of those bloggers I had met a number of years before, and he wrote something to the effect of, "Okay, Arab world, you've seen how it's done. Tag, you're it."
Right.
And that really struck me. So I basically started blocking out time on my schedule just in case protests broke out elsewhere, and that's exactly what happened.
Right. Let me ask you a couple questions that you actually posed in your prologue about whether you can trust reports from so-called citizen journalists who are all actively taking part in the revolution. Like in Tunisia, there were several activist bloggers that you used. How do you know when it's true and when it's a rumor? And I know you can never know for sure, but what's your thought process as you vet this?
For a number of these revolutions, the only people who were using social media were people who were in opposition to the government. So they were activists and protesters and the like. And they made no bones about their political opinions. You knew exactly where they stood. And so it's not that different than using a source who's a political activist when it comes to American politics, for example. They can be useful in certain ways, but you can't forget what role they're playing either because they have an agenda. And so there are times when what they're discussing is essentially their own personal patriotic fervor, you have to take that with a grain of salt. Mm-hmm. But if a group of them are scattered across Tahrir Square and within a minute of each other all report an explosion happening somewhere or upload a series of videos that show protesters getting beaten up, they're also playing a role as a form of journalists. Now, we can debate what type of journalism that is because clearly they have an agenda, but nonetheless, they are documenting what's happening on the ground. And so there's still a role that they play in terms of capturing the story as it plays out. Now, in terms of sorting out what's true and what's not and authenticating things, fortunately, I have enough Twitter followers who volunteered with me to help do that. The people who follow me on Twitter, there are people who are former military, they're medical professionals, they're people who know pretty much every Arabic dialect in the region. And so they'll watch videos for me and translate them and identify the dialects or identify things in the background that might be some sort of landmark or a mosque or something that we can then cross-reference via Google Earth to be sure that that's the exact location of where it happened. They also do things like they look at astronomical charts to see where the moon should be in the sky at a certain moment and whether it should be waxing or waning or what the weather is locally. And so they pull out all of these tricks that collectively help you sort out on many occasions what's authentic and what isn't.
And how do you handle when there's a post that's wrong? I know that at Sandy Hook there was a controversy about a tweet that identified the brother as a person involved. And then, of course, that person retweeted and said, ignore that previous tweet, but that previous tweet was already out there running around.
Yes, Sandy Hook is, I think in many ways, is a notorious example of how badly things can go wrong when reporting on breaking news because a number of news organizations named a person who ended up being the brother of the shooter and also flashed pictures from his Facebook page across their websites and broadcast screens. And it took them some time to realize that he wasn't the right guy. And so you do have to be very, very careful about this. Fortunately, during the Arab Spring, I never found myself in a circumstance that was that egregious. Usually, I would say there's more confusion when things are happening. It's, mm-hmm. you know, the fog of war plays out online just as it does offline. And so when there's major news happening, it's not unusual to get contradictory reports, not only from the citizen journalists, but government officials. In the case of Libya, for example, the Libyan opposition government was notorious for saying contradictory things at any given moment. And so it was very hard to know what to believe in many, many instances, which is why it became even more important to work with people who knew the country well and could help me dissect the footage that was coming out of it, as well as to remain engaged with our reporters on the ground, whether they were in Tripoli or Benghazi or elsewhere, to connect the dots as best we could.
Right. Let's talk just a bit about the kind of the cat and mouse game now with the government and with the protesters and insurgents. I know in Tunisia, the government was blocking sites, so I understand they started using dating sites to get the word out.
The Tunisians basically used any website that they could access to help spread the word. So when YouTube was blocked, Facebook would blossom even more as a place where people would post things. Rather than using YouTube, they would use alternative video sharing sites. There are reports of using bulletin boards and dating sites and other things. Wherever there was space for them to upload content and share it, and do it as safely as possible, you would see them doing it. But what's incredible is you would see people taking risks as well. Like one of the people I knew in Tunisia, I saw her posting all sorts of things on her Facebook page that could have gotten her deeply in trouble if she had ever been arrested. And a week after the revolution, she happened to be in Washington, D.C. So I met up with her and I asked her about that. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you know, why on earth would you use your real Facebook account for this? And she said, well, I knew that there were only so many options for me. Either we would win, or I might be arrested or forced into exile or worse. And no matter what happened, she wanted to be recorded on the right side of history, and she wanted her real name to be associated with that.
So speaking of history, now that you put together these 100,000 or so tweets into a book and about what the events in Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, Yemen, and Syria, and you've been able to get some reaction on your book and put this in perspective. So do you consider this point in journalism to be a revolution in the profession?
Well, I think there's a dramatic shift that's taking place right now in which mainstream media no longer monopolizes information in what's considered news. I think for anyone who followed along the Arab Spring, a couple things stood out. First of all, you had people like me and others who volunteered as additional intermediaries collecting this information and sorting through it and making it available through platforms that didn't exist even a few years ago. But on top of that, you've got members of the public who can ignore the media, they can ignore me and all these other people who are volunteering in these efforts and go straight to the sources themselves, because you have so many people on the ground using their cell phones and satellite connections or whatever they had to report on their own experiences. And so I think the real revolution that's taking place is that the audience isn't really an audience anymore, mm-hmm. in the sense that they can actively choose what news they're going to consume and how they're going to consume it. And if they choose to, directly engage with the players on the ground that are part of the story.
And even with all the new technology, the storytelling still boil down to being able to have good news judgment, to develop good sources. Can you talk about, even though the tech tools have changed, it still gets down to some basic principles of journalism?
Yeah, I think for people like me that are trying to sort through this matrix of information, we have to use the same type of journalistic filters to figure out what's true and what's not. You know, I'm just as equally responsible for sharing incorrect information through Twitter as I would be through doing it on a broadcast. One thing that's different through Twitter, though, is I have the opportunity to share something that's a rumor, but placing it in the context of it being a rumor in order to engage the public to help me sort out what's true or not. So in that sense, what I'm doing, my Twitter account is kind of like this collaborative open source newsroom where you get to see the sausage being made. And not only that, if you're interested, you get to participate in it too. A lot of journalistic values, they still apply when doing the type of work I'm doing. Meanwhile, for these revolutionaries and other people on the ground trying to share what's happening, they struggle with this too because they have no experience as reporters most of the time. And so it's not unusual when a conflict breaks out somewhere that you see people with every single tweet or Facebook post, they're writing the words confirmed or breaking in all cap letters. And after a while, their level of excitement is drowning out whether or not they're possibly accurate. And so one of the things I end up doing is asking these people to step back a bit and understand that if they want to share their stories and have their stories utilized by mainstream media, we need to develop more trust with them and have a better understanding of how they go about collecting information and sharing it. And so in that sense, what I end up doing ends up becoming almost like this giant media literacy experiment for both my Twitter followers as well as my sources.
In some ways, you're like a seismologist who you start to feel some tremors out there, and you think there might be an earthquake coming.
The funny thing is that's both figurative and literal, because there have been a number of times where I've used social media to report on earthquakes as people are proclaiming them in different places. And in one case, literally during the couple of days that Tripoli was being liberated, we had an earthquake in Washington, D.C., the largest one in living memory. And so I had the strange opportunity of literally finishing a tweet halfway about Libya and then having it all be gobbledygook after that because my keyboard started shaking.
It
really is. But I think generally speaking, one of the things I'm really trying to focus on is what we can do at NPR to give people the social media literacy skills to have a similar inner seismograph with them, to embrace their inner seismologist, because what I'm doing isn't rocket science. There's a bit of practice involved, but a lot of it is simply putting yourself into the heads of potential eyewitnesses to see, to figure out how they would describe what's happening to them from their point of view, as well as using social media to cultivate new types of source networks. And so, again, it's taking a lot of the basic principles that have existed in journalism for a long time and taking the best aspects of it and trying to apply it to these new tools.
Some of your sources, you actually met, and does that really help to actually meet people who you'll end up using as a source?
It certainly changes the dynamic of the relationship. There were some sources that I've had in Libya, for example, that I didn't know their age or even their gender until I met them in person. There's always something to be said about being able to look a source in the eye or shake their hand and break bread with them to develop a stronger sense of trust and ideally creating better journalism out of it. But at the same time, there are sources that I've never met before, I probably never will, and they've proved to be absolutely invaluable. And so it's a very different dynamic, and it definitely adds an extra layer of complexity in terms of the journalist source relationship, but I'm really glad that I've had the opportunity to go to Egypt and Tunisia and Libya and several other countries since the revolutions began to meet a number of these sources in person.
Right, and as you're developing, helping NPR to develop its way of covering breaking news, you've been called by Jeff Jarvis in your foreword a prototype for a new kind of journalist. Are you sensing that journalistic test piloting that you did in the Arab Spring uprisings is being used by other media outlets more now?
Yeah, I think in general there's been a fairly sizable shift in the perceptions towards social media in newsrooms. You're pretty hard-pressed to turn on a cable news network, for example, and not seeing some form of citizen journalism throughout the day. Networks have learned to rely on it. Some might say over-rely on it, depending on the context. Many news organizations like the AP, Reuters, New York Times, Wall Street Journal have started building teams of people who have the social media chops to work in a newsroom, to be the social media seismologist we were discussing before.
Right.
And so, I mean, people aren't necessarily trying to replicate me personally in newsrooms, but I think a lot of the principles of what I and other journalists who use social media have been doing is now being applied more broadly. But having said that, these are still early days. There's a lot more experimenting to be done, and more mapping out of when this can be useful and when it shouldn't be, when it can't be useful, because certainly there are going to be plenty of stories out there where social media doesn't necessarily help in terms of the reporting or the storytelling.
Right. Now, finally, you worked 18 hours a day, 7 days a week during the Arab Spring. That must have been taken a toll personally on you.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, I have a feeling I probably experienced something that's not that different from a reporter on the ground in a conflict zone in terms of the adrenaline rush you get out of it. I mean, obviously, I'm not there. I'm not putting myself in life or death situations. But nonetheless, I'm engaging people in real time who are in life and death situations. And so at times it felt like weeks would pass by without me even realizing that I should actually be exhausted. Fortunately, my family's been very supportive of it. They certainly were at the time. We also worked out a routine where I made sure that each evening I had plenty of quality time with my kids.
Yeah.
So I was in charge of cooking dinner and giving them baths and reading to them and things like that. And so even if I'm essentially plugged into the matrix of what the Arab Spring was at the time, I wasn't completely lost within it either. And I think in many ways that helped me keep my sanity.
Well, I just wanted to let our listeners and viewers know that Distant Witness is the name of the book, and it's out now. And I really enjoyed it, and I think you all will too. Andy Carvin has joined us today. And Andy, finally, do you see potential for a movie here?
I think the thought of a camera pointing at someone who's sitting in front of a laptop or an iPhone for 2 hours would make for rather ponderous viewing. But having said that, I think there's certainly the possibility that some of the people who experienced the Arab Spring and use social media to document it, their stories are worth telling in all sorts of ways. So who knows what the possibilities are there.
All right. Andy, it's been great talking to you.
Likewise.
Okay.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
You can listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org, where you can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program. Please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or on our Facebook page. You could also follow us on Twitter at globaljourn. Our program is produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Our program is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungakar is our executive producer. Just ahead is Free Press Watch. And please join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
And now Free Press Watch, a segment on Global Journalist where each week we bring you a rundown of major events affecting press freedom around the world. I'm Kyle Cardine. Today's news comes from the South China Morning Post, Reporters Without Borders, and The Voice of Russia. Two Hong Kong journalists were attacked outside of a Nobel Peace Prize winner's home in Beijing on March 8th. Journalists attempted to interview Liu Xia, wife of prize winner Liu Xiaobo, and is currently under house arrest, when a group of men ran up to the group and attacked two cameramen. No one is yet to be arrested for the offense. A journalist who was abducted in Syria has escaped from her kidnappers and is safe in Damascus. The Ukrainian Foreign Ministry said on March 11th, Anar Kokhneva was kept for several months by a group named the Free Syrian Army in October. Kokhneva says she still plans on staying in Damascus and reporting on the conflict. For more information on these and other events affecting press freedom around the world, please visit our website at globaljournalist.org. Thank you for joining us this week on Global Journalist. I'm Kyle Cardine. See you next week.